Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure, and a privilege to be here. We'll go ahead and present the slides, and then we will go ahead and proceed with the case presentation that you have ready. So, with regards to the with the objectives, I would really would want you to be able to discuss the clinical signs and symptoms of dementia, and be able to differentiate that from depression and delirium. We would also want to discuss, you know, the behavioral disturbances and dementia, and would like you to at least be able to list three types of these behavioral disturbances that you commonly see. And then towards the end of the presentation, I would want to discuss the some of the legal and ethical issues that are related to patients who have dementia that you might encounter in your practice. All right, so as we all know that the US is, among many other countries, is aging. We currently have about 5.4 million US citizens with diagnosis of dementia. And that number actually is expected to at least double by 2050. Okay, so we're looking at more than 12 million patients with dementia in the US. And a big majority of these patients actually are is age 85 and above. So we're dealing with a old population. So before we talk about dementia, I would like to discuss normal aging. So only 5% of people who are 65 and above carry the diagnosis of dementia. So not all old people would have the disease, and actually it's abnormal for anyone to have dementia. So it's not a normal thing. It's more common with as we get older, for sure. But it's never a quote unquote, you know, like a normal you know, phenomena. So what does happen as we get older in terms of cognition? So it would be expected that you know, older people would complain of some memory complaints, you know, that they are, you know, like a little bit forgetful, you know, like here and there. But typically, you know, like that forgetfulness, you know, does not interfere, you know, like with their ability to function. You know, as we got older, we might forget, you know, like where we left, you know, like our keys or our phone. But then, you know, we think about it for, you know, like for a few seconds, and, you know, we'd be able to find the phone, or we can ask for help. Okay, so these subjective memory complaints are typically annoying, but not disabling. It's also common for older folks who do not have dementia to complain of or to have some name retrieval problems, meaning I would meet you, you know, and then, you know, I'll meet you again in a week or so, and might be kind of like forgetful of, you know, like of your name. But then with prompting, you know, like most people would be able to retrieve that. I know some of us, you know, suffer from that, you know, like right now. But it's probably due to, you know, to the lot of input, you know, that we receive. And there's also some, you know, like little bit of difficulties in recalling, you know, like detailed events. So we might be able to basically recall, you know, general events. But when it comes to description, we might have a little bit of a problem describing the details of what happened. Okay, so all of that is normal, quote unquote, and expected. Okay, but that does not mean, you know, that someone would have dementia. So what conditions are not dementia? Again, we talked about, you know, like age-related cognitive decline, where we have mild memory problems. Depression at times, you know, can look like dementia. So when patients or people, you know, like got depressed, one of the symptoms, you know, that can appear is short-term memory loss. Okay, so people would have decreased ability to remember things. especially things, you know, that occurred in the recent past, that they might have difficulty telling, you know, like what happened yesterday or what they had for breakfast or who visited them, you know, like last night. And that can be very much, you know, related to depression. So when you treat, you know, the depressive symptoms, you know, that memory, you know, like tend to improve. Delirium is another big one. And it's acute, you know, like confusion, you know, that occur typically in relation to a medical disease or a medical problem. So let's say, you know, grandma or grandpa, they are doing well. And all of a sudden, you know, grandma woke up this morning and she's very confused. She's altered. She doesn't know where she is and she does not know what the date is. Okay, so it's an acute change. So typically that is not dementia, right? Because it happened, you know, like very acutely. Dementia tend to happen, you know, like gradually for a period of, you know, like months and even years. So that condition is called, typically called delirium, and is due to a medical condition. One of the most common medical conditions that would cause delirium could be a urinary tract infection, something like constipation or pneumonia, anything of that sort, you know, can actually cause, you know, like delirium. And yes, I get, you know, like few laughs here about, you know, constipation. Constipation can be extremely, you know, extremely severe, you know, like in the, you know, like in the elderly, and can cause, you know, like bowel obstruction and you know, like precipitate, you know, like that acute, you know, like confusion, you know, like in mental state. So yes, things, you know, that are, you know, usually very common, we don't typically, you know, like think about, but can definitely, you know, like precipitate, you know, like an acute confusional state. And we often actually, even as providers, you know, like miss that because we don't, you know, like often think about it. All right, here's an overview of brain anatomy. In the red area in the front, that is, you know, the frontal lobe, and that is responsible for intelligence, judgment, and behavior. People or patients who suffer from, you know, like a traumatic brain injury or have, you know, a dementia that is affecting, you know, like their frontal lobe, they might, you know, start experiencing, you know, personality problems and, you know, like, and disinhibition. A typical example would be, you know, you have a 60-year-old, you know, like, for example, professor at UNM walking on campus and, you know, newly diagnosed, let's say, with frontotemporal dementia, and then, you know, like he would see him, you know, taking his pants off and, you know, like, and, you know, like peeing in public. Okay, so it's very atypical of you know, like of him to do that, and then can be, you know, like a sign and symptom of, you know, like of a dementia. So it's very disinhibited, or hypersexual behaviors, you know, that sometimes, you know, like occur, inappropriate, you know, like touching or, you know, groping strangers. Okay. The green area, and that is the temporal lobe, and that is responsible for memory. So any impairment, you know, like in that area of the brain can cause memory loss. And typically we start with short-term memory loss, and then with severe cases of dementia, you know, long-term memory loss is obtained. And that purple, you know, area, that is the parietal lobe, and that is the region of the brain that is responsible for language. We typically find with patients with dementia, especially in the moderate stages, where people will start to have impairment in their language. Sometimes, you know, they repeat, you know, like words. Sometimes they have difficulty finding words. So any of that, you know, like can occur. Now, what does it entail to diagnose dementia? Again, as I mentioned prior, there should be, you know, like deficits in cognition, and a deficit in any of those domains that would occur for a gradual period of, you know, like a month or years, can occur in dementia. So typically, patients can have impairment in memory, in language. They will have difficulty doing or executing purposeful movements. So what does that mean? So let's say, something as, like paying a bill, or, sending a check, they might have difficulty, writing down, the right amount of money, or have difficulty, mailing a check. They may mail it to the wrong, recipient, so on and so forth. Okay. Patients can have difficulty, recognizing familiar object. So that is typical. Let's say, you have someone who is demented and they want to brush, their hair, so they can use, a toothbrush actually, to brush their hair. Okay, so I have difficulty recognizing, the toothbrush as a toothbrush, and they think it's a comb. Okay, problem with visual spatial functioning, and that is related to, to their ability to, estimate, distances, and that, dysfunction can be very apparent with, with when people drive, when demented people drive, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, in addition, poor self-control, can occur. I talked about, the UNM professor who is, peeing in public. Okay, so how do we diagnose dementia? So there's no particular, test or a battery, that we use to diagnose it, and unfortunately, there's not a lab test. So what we rely on the diagnosis is with basically interviewing the patient and doing some cognitive testing, and getting labs, and sometimes, brain imaging is warranted. All of these, things can aid us with the diagnosis. So the diagnosis of dementia remains to be a clinical one. Okay, so there's no lab test to diagnose it. Okay, so on the left-hand side, we have a cross-section of a healthy brain, and on the right-hand side, we see a brain with advanced Alzheimer's disease. So we see, how the brain is, is all shrunk, and there's a lot of basically, curvatures, that are very apparent, and lots of holes. Okay, so that is, a cross-section of a brain with advanced Alzheimer's. Now, living with dementia is extremely difficult, as you can all, imagine. So people can, start getting lost in familiar places while driving, or walking. They might not be able to recognize, familiar faces. That usually start happening with acquaintances, and then as dementia progresses, patients might have, or people might have, difficulty recognizing family members. Wandering. That is never normal, and we can discuss, that, but I'm pretty sure that you have some experience, with that, in law enforcement, getting calls and, with reports of, missing individuals with dementia. Confusion can definitely occur. People might not be, oriented to place. And they might just, know their names, and in advanced cases, they do not able to actually tell their names. Urinary incontinence, and can definitely occur, and basically precipitate, infections, pain, or many demented patients, have comorbid, pain problems, and due to the severity of dementia, they will not be able to, express, their pain, just like with, with infants or toddlers who have decreased ability to express themselves. So what do? They act out. Okay, and you can see, similar behaviors in patients with dementia that is severe.
Dr. Kapadia.
And feeding problem. Yes, sir.
Hi, it's Dr. Burad. I had a question about how early you generally see urinary incontinence and feeding problems.
So typically, urinary incontinence and feeding problems do occur in moderate to advanced, stages. That typically happens, but that does not mean, that you can't have, these symptoms, early on. But typically, it's, it's more of an advanced, in advanced cases.
Can I ask a question? What about psychosis? Do they ever get like some kind of almost psychotic thoughts and ideas, and what would that fall under?
Absolutely. So we're getting to that. I think that is in the, next slide. No, that's a great question. I just want to reiterate one important thing about, you know, feeding problems. So that can basically, you know, like precipitate or cause, you know, difficulty, you know, like swallowing, and can you know, like ultimately cause, you know, aspiration pneumonias and infection. So we often, for example, on the Jerry unit, you know, like order swallow studies in order to, you know, like assess the ability of, you know, like patients to swallow, you know, like food. Many of the patients have difficulty swallowing, you know, like solid food, and then they would, you know, would recommend, you know, kind of like a soft mechanical diet or even fluids sometimes. Now, what are the most common, you know, behavioral and psychological manifestations of dementia? Of course, you know, like depression and anxiety can occur. Anxiety is, you know, like is a very common one. Any thoughts about what kind of anxiety patients with dementia can exhibit?
Like anger, sometimes frustration.
So anger, absolutely. So anger, frustration. You know, they are confused. You know, they are frustrated about that. You know, they, you know, want to look for, you know, like objects, you know, that they kind of actually, you know, like left around, and, you know, and they're unable to find it, so they get anxious, you know, like, and, you know, and irritable, okay? Delusions and hallucinations is a very common one, specifically, and again, in moderate to advanced stages. And the most common delusion of dementia is? What's the most common delusion of dementia?
Stealing things. Some people stealing or...
Right, so very good. So typically delusions of paranoia are very common, and delusion of theft, okay, which is like, you know, it's a very, you know, it's a very typical, you know, like example, okay? So a grandma or, you know, a grandpa is basically accusing family members of, you know, of stealing their money. Unfortunately, that often occurs, okay? But still, you know, it is a very common delusion. So we would need, you know, as healthcare providers, and, you know, like, you know, to try to differentiate or suss out, you know, like what is real and what is unreal. And sometimes, you know, that is extremely difficult. Hallucinations are also, you know, like very, very typical, both auditory and visual hallucinations. You know, patient with dementia can basically hear voices of people who are not there, you know, or believe, you know, that people are coming in, you know, like to the house and, you know, like telling them stuff. So that can definitely occur, specifically in the moderate to severe stages. Changes in appetite can also happen. As dementia progresses, it becomes difficult for people to be able to taste food. Okay, so that gets impaired. So with decreased ability, you know, like to taste food, okay, that decreases, you know, the appetite, and that can cause, you know, like ultimately, you know, like malnourishment.
Dr. Kavaja, is the
yes.
Decreased ability to taste food something specific to dementia? Is it something that we see in general as people get much older?
So it's not necessarily, you know, like specific with dementia. You can see a variant of that with, you know, like with older age, but that is more pronounced with, you know, with patients with dementia. Having, you know, like decreased ability to taste in older individuals might raise the flag for some, you know, like cognitive assessment, but that does not mean, you know, that someone has dementia if they have decreased ability, you know, like to taste. But it would definitely, you know, like warrant, you know, more thorough, you know, like cognitive testing when patients, you know, present as such. Okay, so dementia care can be, again, is very difficult on the individual, you know, suffering from the disease, but it's also, in my opinion, more difficult on, you know, on the caregivers, okay? So patients with dementia, they would typically, you know, need 24-hour care and supervision. They would need help with their you know, activities of daily living, you know, a lot of things, you know, that we take, you know, like for granted. But then they would need to have, you know, assistance with eating, with bathing, with even, you know, like dressing. Safety is an important, you know, like aspect, you know, keeping dangerous, you know, chemicals, tools, and even sharp knives, you know, from their access. Discussing, you know, like bed and bathroom, you know, like safety, and removing, you know, locks from, you know, like bathrooms and bedrooms, and making sure, you know, that lowering the hot temperature to 120 Fahrenheit or, you know, or less. Because again, you know, these patients have decreased ability to basically also to, you know, like sensation, and they might have, you know, like burns without their ability to feel, you know, like or sense, you know, a temperature. Okay, so what are the things, you know, that we can do to reduce risk of dementia? So just want to let you know that up until now, you know, there are medications that can, that we, that are FDA approved to possibly basically not improve, you know, like dementia per se, but help with the behavioral disturbances of, you know, like of dementia. But there's no, you know, like FDA approved medication as of yet that would treat the disease. So we always emphasize, you know, regular exercise, Mediterranean diet, doing, you know, intellectually stimulating, you know, like exercises, you know, such as, you know, Sudoku, for example. Patients are, you know, people are interested in that. Maintaining and controlling, you know, cholesterol and high blood pressure and diabetes. That's extremely important because any of those, you know, can also cause, you know, a certain type of dementia called vascular dementia. So it would be important for people to have all of those, you know, like under control. And there are some studies suggesting that vitamin E and B supplementation can help reduce, you know, the risk. Again, all of these things, you know, studies have shown that they can reduce the risk, but they are not, you know, they are not, you know, like definite or absolute treatments. So going back to caregivers who are helping out with, you know, with people with dementia, as I mentioned, it's a very difficult job. It would be extremely important to basically assess for, you know, like for depression and anxiety in that, you know, in that patient population. So you often go to someone's home or you bring these patients with clinics. The patient is very demented, you know, they're unaware what's going on, and you typically see the family member is very depressed, very anxious, agitated, you know, like irritable. And that, you know, like if that is not, you know, treated, sometimes, you know, can cause basically patients, you know, like to be, you know, like to be harmed, you know, like by their caregiver, you know, like due to their, you know, to the frustration. So it would be extremely important to recognize, you know, these early signs and symptoms of, you know, depression or caregiver burnout, and be able to educate, you know, the family members about that. Okay, many of, for many of the family members, you know, we can recommend, you know, like support groups, individual counseling, or even, you know, like group therapy.
Are there support groups in the Albuquerque area for that?
So there are support groups in the Albuquerque area. So we have the Alzheimer's, you know, like association, you know, we have a chapter here in Albuquerque in the northeast side of town. So it's a great resource. And also at, you know, at the mental health center and seniors clinic, we have one of the nurses, you know, like over there that run groups for, you know, like for caregivers.
Through UNM.
Okay, so I'd like to discuss this case. So we have a neighbor who calls 911 for a wellness check on an 81-year-old who's living alone. So you go in there as, you know, like law enforcement, and, you know, the house smells of urine, you know, there are cat feces on the floor. You talk to the woman, I mean, you have a look at the woman, she appears to be, you know, like physically well. She's alert and oriented to person and place, you know. However, she, you know, you get concerned because of the kind of, the presentation of the house. And you suggest, you know, that, you know, the patient is get transported to the ER for, you know, for a well-being check. And she refuses. So how would you approach, you know, like this, this individual? Do you say, okay, that's okay, I'll come back later? Or do you, quote unquote, you know, try to force her or convince her to come to the ER? How do you make that determination? And again, there's no right or wrong answer here. I'm just trying basically to, you know, like elicit your responses and see how we think about that. Any volunteers?
Hold on, no one else is. Is there anyone on the network that wants to? No. Detective Savage with APD. I think I would start with trying to collect some collateral information, like as far as family support, so that I could get kind of a baseline. Is this something that's normal to her? Is, you know, or has the patient declined? Like over the last 6 months, is it slowly getting to this point? Try to figure out if she has been to the hospital before, if they've diagnosed her with anything. And then just kind of work on trying to convince her that it's probably for her best interest that she go to try to get help. And that might be, I think that's going to be tricky, but I think if you get family support there to say, yeah, you know, grandma, you have been kind of declining lately and we want you there so you can take care of your cats, you know, I think that that's the approach I would take. I don't think you have enough to force her there, but I think you might be able to talk her into it. And if you can't that time, then it's not just that and over. I think you need to do follow-up and try to, because then you'll have your own baseline of when you met her and over the weeks if she's declining. I think if you can articulate her decline a little bit more, you might be able to eventually take her against her will.
Absolutely. So I think that is, you know, that is a great approach. What we're facing here is basically, you know, like patient autonomy, right? You know, like versus safety. Okay. So we are all respectful of, you know, of patients or persons, you know, like ability to make decision for him or herself. Okay. But at the same time, you know, like being in, you know, I guess in law enforcement and, you know, and you know, like in medicine, you know, we are here, you know, like to help, you know, like to help individuals and, you know, like, and make sure, you know, that they are, you know, safe. And sometimes, you know, both of those, you know, like principles, you know, they get at odds, you know, like with, you know, like with each other. Okay, you have someone there, you know, like who does not want, you know, like to come into the, you know, to the or to the hospital for a welfare check, but you're still concerned about them. And then, you know, like, what do you do? So I think what you provided in terms of a thought process or a way to think about it is very appropriate. It would be extremely important to basically, you know, get collateral information, maybe contact a family member and see if there's an acute thing or a chronic issue, and then try to convince, you know, like the patient to basically to seek more, you know, like help or assistance. And if that is not possible, you know, like at that particular period of time, then to try to arrange, you know, like for, you know, for further follow up, you know, like in the, you know, like in the near future. So let me go ahead and mention.
Sorry to interrupt you there. Sergeant Pullen wrote about Adult Protective Services, maybe making a referral to them if it's a lower level one.
Absolutely. So that is, you know, like an integral part of the follow-up. Thank you for that comment. That is extremely important, and I missed to mention it. So we try to, you know, like involve, you know, like Adult Protective Services, you know, like in these cases where we suspect, you know, that there is, you know, like neglect or abuse, you know, that is going on. Thank you for that. Okay. So these four ethical principles, you know, remain to be the main principles that would guide, you know, like our basically care when we deal with patients. And that has nothing necessarily to do with dementia per se. So that pertains to all patients, okay? So it's important for us as healthcare providers to respect patients' autonomy, okay? So freedom or ability to make a choice, okay? We need to do good, right? So beneficence. Okay, we need to help them out, do no harm, and do justice, or whatever we think is, you know, is fair for the patient. Okay, so sometimes, again, as I mentioned, you know, these principles, you know, come at odds, you know, like against each other. Okay, such as the principle of, you know, like freedom versus, you know, like doing good. Okay, So, and what does pertain in your opinion if the patient is able to make decisions regarding his or her care? So the principle of autonomy, okay, is the one, you know, that would dominate, you know, like over here, okay? So if someone, if an individual, you know, comes and tell you, you know, I know that I'm sick, but I do not want to go to the hospital for a valid reason, you know, that they have, you know, that their autonomy need to be respected, okay? However, that only pertains when individuals have the ability to make rational decisions, okay? So let's say, you know, you have an elderly demented person who's telling you that they do not want to come, he or she does not want to come into the hospital because, there is basically aliens, you know, like are going to meet her at the hospital in order to kidnap her, okay? And that's why she does not want to go over there, okay? So that is an overt delusion, okay? That, in my opinion, does not mean that's irrational and would not mean, you know, that the patient is able to make a decision on his or her behalf, okay? So it's really important for us to try to differentiate and figure out if, you know, if the patient or the person is able to make decisions on his or her own behalf. And sometimes if patients are unable to do that, you know, they have a medical power of attorneys or family members who would be able to make, you know, like decisions on his on their behalf. So what does get involved in determining, you know, like decisional capacity? So how would we determine if someone is able to make his or her own decisions? Okay, so it's extremely important to be able to communicate a choice as a person, whether that is, you know, like verbal or written, okay? Be able to understand the nature and the consequence of that choice, that if I do not come into the hospital, that, you know, for example, you know, that my blood pressure is going to be very high and then I'm going to possibly, you know, like suffer a stroke, okay? They would be able to understand that information and make the necessary choice. And their reasoning should be consistent with choices, you know, that they've made in the, you know, like in the past, right? So if you know someone who is, you know, very health conscious and, you know, they always, you know, like went to the doctors to take care of things and, you know, they always had, you know, for example, you know, their blood pressure, you know, like checked and all of a sudden, you know, like they don't care, you know, they don't want to go to the doctor, you know, they even deny, you know, that they have, you know, like blood pressure problems, okay, then that might, you know, like raise, you know, like a red flag. Okay.
Can I ask a quick question on that? What if they're in care, you've taken them to the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and they don't want to comply, they don't want to eat, they don't want to take meds, they don't want to, where does that, when you start talking about that ethical dilemma, how does the hospital look at that?
So that's a great question. So we assess, you know, like these cases on obviously on individual basis, okay? Mm-hmm. We try to determine, you know, like again, what's the reason of the, you know, like for the refusal. Sometimes, you know, like patients who are extremely, you know, like depressed, you know, like they get catatonic and, you know, and very paranoid, you know, they refuse to eat or drink and they just sit in bed, you know, like all day, okay? So with these individuals, you know, if we determine that they do not have capacity to consent to treatment, we try to get them, you know, like treatment guardian, you know, like in court. And try to get them treatment, you know, against their will or until, you know, they get better and be able to make, you know, like a decision either or.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. So law enforcement and dementia, again, I'm pretty certain that you encounter, many individuals who suffer from dementia or cognitive impairment. And these guidelines I was able to get from the Alzheimer's Association. There's a chapter that is dedicated for law enforcement. I don't know if any of you have seen that before.
That's great.
It's really helpful. It's there on the, you know, on the website. Typically, you know, law enforcement deal with, you know, like erratic driving, motor vehicle accidents, right? False reports, you know, patients, even on the unit, you know, they call 911 while they are on the Jerry psych unit, right? You know, falsely accusing, you know, like staff of, you know, of kidnapping or of, you know, like, or abuse, even in psych emergency services, you know, that often, you know, occur. Indecent exposure, right? You have a 70-year-old, you know, like walking, you know, like naked on the street. Okay, so that is never normal. And we, right.
Sometimes.
Yeah. I'm almost there. Right. So,
we typically look for, again, for a, you know, like a medical, you know, like etiology, you know, is the patient, again, you know, physically sick, they have an infection, are they high on drugs, or is there, you know, like a dementia going on? Shoplifting, you know, that often can also occur. And again, patients with dementia are at increased risk of suicide, and then and they are also able to, you know, harm, you know, like others, you know, like due to, you know, like confusion and fear. So sometimes, you know, they, you know, lash out consciously or unconsciously or subconsciously in order to protect, you know, like themselves. I remember a patient who was admitted to the geropsych unit a few years ago. Was basically in a nursing home, and he had, you know, moderate dementia. So the nurse came in to pass meds, and I think he got scared or something. So he took a TV set and he threw the TV set, you know, like on the nurse, sustaining, you know, like pretty serious injury on the behalf of the nurse. Okay, so that landed him an admission to the geropsych unit. Okay, so sometimes, you know, these behavioral disturbances, you know, like do occur, and they are very severe. Okay, just want to discuss a little bit driving patients with dementia. So dementia increases the risk of crashing. Okay, so that is, you know, that is a fact. Okay, it's one of the most contentious issues, you know, that we typically deal with, you know, like in healthcare. Okay, many of the patients, you know, one of the most common reasons of patients, you know, like storming out of the office is, you know, like when you tell them, you know, that it's not recommended for them to be, you know, like to be driving. Okay, it's like depriving them of their basically of their freedom, right? So it's extremely contentious. Many of the patients, you know, like do not understand that the illness is, you know, is getting worse, and that is again part of the illness because, you know, their cognition, you know, gets impaired. Road evaluations remains the gold standard for assessing for safety. Okay, so, and that is, you know, the MVD is, you know, is responsible for doing that. And few states here in the US, you know, like mandate, you know, the physicians to report drivers with dementia, such as, you know, like California. Here in, bless you, here in New Mexico, there's an MVD Medicare report, you know, like form that is available online. And when we suspect, you know, like impaired driving, and when there's a diagnosis of dementia or seizure disorder, an acute medical issue, and we believe that the patient is not fit to drive, then we, in my opinion, it's our, you know, like moral and ethical responsibility, you know, like to fill out, you know, like that form and, you know, like inform the MVD. We mailed it to the MVD in Santa Fe. They contact the patient, and then they basically take further steps to assess them for, you know, for ability to drive. And I have, you know, a few patients who are like their driver's license actually was revoked because of them being unable to drive, you know, like in a safe manner.
I have a question. Matt Smith, APD. Mm-hmm. Do you have to let your patients know you're doing that?
You don't have to, but I, for sake of transparency, and to be clear with the patient, I do that, okay? I would rather be the bad guy rather than, you know, like the another family member informing the patient and being the bad guy.
Would you ever just take away their keys?
That's a very good, many family members, you know, like do that, okay?
As you as a doctor saying, I'm a doctor, I'm taking your keys.
Yeah, no, I wish I can do that, but I don't have magical powers.
Magical powers?
Apparently Nils has magical powers.
Yeah, except for Dr. Rosenbaum. So many family members, you know, like go ahead and do that. You know, they take, you know, like keys away, or, you know, they take, you know, the car battery away, right?
Huh.
So, but
hide the car.
Right. So I believe it's, you know, again, I have a low threshold about, you know, like reporting, and I tell the patient that I'm not making the decision to, you know, to take away your driver's license. I'm just doing my job in terms of, you know, like reporting you, and it would be really up to the MVD, you know, to make that decision.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So a few tips, you know, that I felt were, you know, like helpful in terms of, you know, interacting with people who might suffer from cognitive impairment. So as we all know, it's extremely important to identify yourself as a law enforcement, you know, like officer. Explain what would be the reason of, you know, of you approaching, you know, the individual. Maintaining good eye contact is very important. Speaking slowly in non-threatening manner. Low pitch voice, you know, is very helpful to calm down patients with cognitive impairment or disorder. Sometimes, you know, they have difficulty actually hearing high pitched voices. Okay, and try to use, you know, like short, you know, like simple words. Asking yes or no questions can, again, help try to identify, you know, like the problem rather than, you know, like asking a very open-ended question that can, you know, further, you know, like confuse the person. Patients with dementia have difficulty multitasking, so asking one question at a time is extremely important, and giving them, you know, like plenty of time to respond. Because of impaired hearing, they can also have, you know, like difficulty teasing out, you know, like multiple voices. So it's extremely important to talk to them in a calm environment where there's not much of an excessive stimuli. Like instead of talking to them, you know, like out in the backyard when it's, you know, it might be, you know, like noisy, maybe just going inside the house and talking to them might be helpful when it's less noisy. Reducing radio volume and avoid use of sirens. Okay. Try to avoid, you know, restraining patients. This is an approach, you know, that we also use in psych emergency services and also on the units. So we always try to take, you know, the least restrictive, you know, like approach. So we typically, you know, spend a lot of time trying to verbally de-escalate, you know, these patients prior to offering medications or even restraining them. As a matter of fact, we got away with restraints on the unit, on the geriatric unit, about a few years ago, because all studies have shown, you know, that they are, you know, can be very harmful and can and would increase, you know, like mortality.
There's no, you don't use them at all?
We don't use them, unless, I mean, in very, very, you know, unusual, you know, circumstances. Yes, but we don't have them on the unit. And of course, avoiding confrontation is extremely important, especially if someone is very confused.